warm welcome to you. My name is Amina Taylor, and this is Remember Palestine. We're wholly dedicated to the plight of the Palestinian people. On this week's show, UNRWA, that's the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, declared 2012 the year of refugee youth. What does this mean for Palestinians for whom the right of return has been a fundamental cornerstone of their struggle? Do younger Palestinians have the same determination as generations past? We'll be looking at the obstacles they face and the ways in which they are being empowered. There'll also be contributions from our correspondents who'll be bringing us up to date with Israel's decision to formalize the status of three outposts and the implications for the Palestinians. But first, Ashraf Shannon files this report from Gaza, where UNRWA announced 10 concrete commitments through which the agency would build stronger links with Palestine's youth.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA, announced during a recent meeting in Brussels 10 concrete commitments through which UNRWA will strengthen its support to Palestine refugee youth. The agency plans to focus on youth in the ongoing agency reforms of its various programs, including enhanced vocational training and microfinance opportunities.
One of the most important program is the vocational training program, and also we have the microfinance program that we're providing to youth through that program of small loans.
We visited UNRWA's vocational training center in Gaza, which is the biggest center for Palestine refugees in the Middle East. Established in 1953, the center evolved into a technical college. Its director had this to say.
We can start a solid and concrete base for guaranteeing the development and improving the standards of living of the Palestinian refugees community.
The UNRWA Technical College provides vocational training to both male and female students, including carpentry, masonry, electrical, automotive, and fashion design. Students were excited to talk about their expectations in the future after they finished their training.
This training gives us the skills and expertise to help us pursue a successful career in the future and helps us in the day-to-day life.
I really expect a very bright future for myself because I get a specialized training here, and I'm looking forward to starting my own business in the near future.
Experts say that young Palestinians are faced with more difficult circumstances and obstacles compared to those of previous generations.
The youth are the same, but the circumstances around them have changed. The harsh realities faced by the youth nowadays makes life harder for them compared to previous generations. With the current limitation, the youth have a hard time achieving their aspirations and dreams.
Youth are the backbone of any nation, and experts believe that it's of the highest importance to address their needs in order to create a successful society.
UNRWA's youth commitments are highly appreciated by Palestinian refugees, especially in the Gaza Strip, where more than 50% of the population is under the age of 18. Ashraf Shannon, reporting for Remember Palestine, Gaza.
Now, UNRWA's declaration that 2012 is the year of the refugee youth can mean more than just theoretical chat for people who are living through that very experience. My next guest is a young Palestinian who knows the pain and struggle behind some of those statistics and headline, and Yasmin Rabah joins me over satellite from Gaza. Good to speak with you, Yasmin. So many of Gaza's population are under the age of 18. Do you feel that there is a weight of expectations on your shoulder to take things forward?
Well, of course, because in everywhere in this world, the people, the youth people, are the next generation of leaders and the next decision makers. And particularly because we are Palestinian, and you know, we have been living under the Israeli occupation for more than 60 years, we have a more pardon in order to lead our nation and to fight for our rights, and also to try to develop the situation that the Palestinian people live in Palestine, in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon, which unfortunately is going from worse to worse each day.
You took part in UNRWA's conference on this issue. Any highlights for you?
Well, the conference that we attended, me and other 23 Palestinian refugee youth in Brussels last month, was the first, let's say, the first chance to make our voices, our messages heard to the world by our own words, by our own experiences, by our own expressions, not in any templates. From youth to the world, in our words. The honor gave us this opportunity, and was a very good opportunity to talk to the world, to the main decision makers, and to reveal many of the things that have been hidden for many years. Now, the commitments of the UNRWA are so useful and so meaningful, but still we say that it's only the starting step and the first step towards a very long journey towards many of the rights, many of the things that the Palestinian refugees should have. They should have a full education, comprehensive one, a very well healthcare provided to them. They should have the right for mobility. We, the 24 youth, met together and shared our experiences, knowing that we are not going to see each other again. Why? Because of the occupation, because of the restrictions imposed on the mobility of any Palestinian refugee. And that's for no reason.
What we was have the also reaction the right to there, Yasmin?
Participate. The reaction of us?
Telling your story, sharing this message with the world.
Well, the reaction was on the part of the people who heard us for the first time. Many of them were surprised because, unfortunately, the people who participate in the media and just send the messages of the Palestinian refugee youth are not youth. That's because the youth are not given the chance and the space to participate and tell their own stories. And that's which caused the people to be surprised, to ask us for more details about our daily life. I mean, not every time we talk about Palestine, we talk about the political side. There is another side, another actually shiny sign. There is the lifestyle. There is the daily lives of so many people. There is the stories, the simple details, the simple happiness that people feel, and which is unfortunately is not announced to the world. And that was our role there, to try to tell the world the other side of the Palestinians, and to prove that we are human beings, and we deserve to enjoy our identity. Why every person in this world enjoying his identity, his passport, except the Palestinians? Whenever you have the Palestinian identity, you are marginalized and you are underestimated, which is not fair.
Yasmin, thank you very much. And what an absolutely sparkling representative of Palestinian youths. Well, on a slightly different topic, but nicely merging, if you ask me, just who are the Palestinians? In his new book, In Your Eyes, A Sandstorm, the British journalist Arthur Nestlin offers an insight into ways of being Palestinian. This report brings us a little more.
The need to keep open spaces for the Palestinian voices to be heard was central to the launch of Arthur Nestlin's book, In Your Eyes, A Sandstorm, in London.
The value of the book is that it allows Palestinians to tell their own stories in their own words from a wide variety of backgrounds, people in Hamas, people in Fatah, people in no organizations. The actual daily lives under occupation are not considered a news story as such. There's no news hook. There's very little enthusiasm within a lot of news bureaus for taking on a subject which could potentially draw in a lot of political criticism and flak, and very little support, and it means that the Palestinian voices don't get heard.
The book is written in a humanistic and journalist inquiry style rather than advocacy journalism, and according to the author, it aims to appeal to both people new to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and confirmed supporters.
My objective in writing these books was to allow the uncontainable, contradictory and multifaceted disco ball of human experience free rein, and then let the reader decide. Give them a direct line to the person on the page.
In spite of the diverse account of the Palestinians' lives in the occupied territories and the diaspora presented in the book, the author expressed that the right to return is seen as something sacred among the different generations.
For most Palestinians who still keep keys within their family of the houses that they were evicted from in 1948 or in periods after that, it's not something that can be compromised on. For refugees, the land is central. For Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, allowing their families and cousins and grandparents and sons to return is not a trivial matter. It's a, as we've seen, it's been a matter of life and death over the generations.
My next guest is Naseen Ahmed. He's the senior researcher at the Palestine Return Center, and he joins me now. Naseen, we saw there with our first guest in Gaza, a young, dynamic young woman, talking about the challenges facing Palestine's youth, and then Arthur's account there of how important it is to keep some of these intergenerational aspirations alive. The right to return, is that still as fundamental for Palestinians as it once was?
The right of return is still the major cornerstone of the Palestinian issue. And as the Palestinians would say, though they don't live in Palestine, Palestine lives in their heart. So for all Palestinians, this is core to their whole issue. But let me comment on what something Yasmin said, which is that the way I see it, a lot of Palestinians do not benefit from the very thing which every other society, every other culture, every other civilization is able to benefit from, which is to pass on the progress and the fruits to their next generation. Palestinians, because of the fact that they are under occupation, because they are living as refugees, they are not able to prosper economically, they are not able to develop as a country, as a state, and as a culture and a civilization. So once they have, once the occupation ends, once their human rights is valued and given to them, the next generation will be able to benefit from the previous generations and can live like every other culture and every other society.
For the young, is it still as critical?
For the young, definitely. I mean, we have lots of conferences, and one of the biggest conferences we have is the European conference, where up to 10,000 Palestinians in diaspora, that is, in, from Germany, from Holland, from the UK, even far away as America, they converge. And half the audience are young Palestinians. And the key message from that conference is Palestinian youth calling for a right to return to their country, to return to their land. Because most of them still have the keys to their land, the deeds to their land. And the normal human reaction is that if there was a great injustice done to their parents and to them, they will not simply surrender their rights. They will actually demand their rights because of the great injustices which has come waves after waves on the Palestinian community.
You think the Arab Spring has affected especially this right of return? When you're in a place like Libya or elsewhere, and they're undergoing their own transformation, everybody else is being airlifted home, quote unquote. Yeah. Where do you go?
That's right. The Arab Spring, if anything, has shown for the Palestinians how the right of return is so central. Since the Nakba in 1948, the Palestinians have been in a vicious cycle of exile, expulsion, relocation. So this has been repeated for many Palestinians. So in 2003, during the invasion of Iraq, you had up to 25,000 Palestinians who actually fled the persecution and war in Iraq. They were in tents between the borders of Iraq and Syria. The Arab Spring, where you had Palestinians fleeing violence in Syria, Palestinians fleeing violence in Libya, and of course parts of Egypt as well. So what this goes to show for the Palestinians is that until their right of return, or they're allowed to exercise their right of return, until they have their homeland back, they will always be in this precarious situation. And any destabilization within the Middle East, any parts of the world, they will be the first to be hit and be the victims of any kind of political turmoil or disturbance.
We talk about the destabilization, the fact that Palestinians abroad will always be the first to be affected by any political changes domestically. What's the political solution to this? Is there a political will to see that this doesn't happen? You can't have a people being moved from pillar to post.
No, you can't. The political solution which the vast majority of Palestinians have been calling for is a right to be able to exercise their basic human rights and to defend their human rights. Of course, since the Oslo Agreement, for most Palestinians, the tract on which the Palestinian political situation has gone is not something which they actually favour. For them, the Palestinian refugee issue has been the core and the central issue. and the political political track which we're on, which somehow imagines that you can deny the human rights of 7 million Palestinians, and this is somehow realistic, and have a scenario or political solution forced onto them. To a lot of Palestinians, this is more unrealistic. It's more unrealistic because 7 million Palestinians will not simply give up their human rights to return back to their land. So for them, this is the solution. And Israel has, the 6 decades we've had, Israel has tried everything except what they think is the right solution, the right for the Palestinians, which is a solution based on international law, based on recognizing basic human rights, allowing Palestinians to return to their homes. This is the solution which Israel has not tested, which the international community has not tried, even though this is a solution which is enshrined under various agreements, various human rights treaties throughout the world. So for Palestinians, this is the only way that the real solution in Palestine will come about.
So there cannot be any kind of political settlement until this is addressed favorably. And the idea that you can just put it to the side and say, let's talk about the other issues in isolation, simply doesn't work.
It's shown that it doesn't work. The fact that we've not had any resolution, we've not had any peace for the last 6.5 decades, is shown that any solution forced onto the Palestinians, which discounts all their human rights and all the injustices that were visited on them throughout the decades, especially the Nakba of 1948, until those issues are addressed, simply forcing a solution, a political solution which favors Israel's aspiration for more and more land without the Palestinians, that's not going to work for Palestinians, and it's shown that it will not work for the region as a whole.
Now, we were talking about these three legal outposts that have been formalized by the Israelis. When we hear about these things taking place again and again, despite the condemnation of sections of the international community, does it just mean the government is allowed to operate carte blanche? It doesn't matter what it does, how much more land it seizes, how it stops this ability of the 7 million plus refugees to return to a homeland?
Yes, this again puts a lie to the many myths which Israel tries to put out, which is that it's serious about a two-state solution. If it was serious about a two-state solution, then why is Israel sabotaging the very solution which it's aspiring for? And it also puts another lie, which is that Palestinians cannot be allowed, there's not enough land to somehow bring Palestinians back to their homeland. Of course there is. If Israel can move Jews into the occupied territory, if Israel can allow Jews from all over the world to even come back to mandate Palestine, to the homes of Palestinians, to the villages of Palestinians that lived before, it shows the issue of population is not the major issue. There's enough space for Jews and Palestinians to live in mandate Palestine. The only problem is the definition of Israel of itself, which is that it wants to be defined as a Jewish state, which is really an ethno-religious religious state. And on the issue of also settlements, if you think about it within Israel as well, forget the fact that there's a...
We have, and I have to put a pin right in the conversation here, Nassim Ahmed. Thank you so much. So much more to talk about. And we now have Ibrahim Hussaini down the line. Ibrahim, bring me the latest on this issue.
Well, the latest is the legalization of three outposts by Netanyahu's cabinet earlier this week. Two of these outposts are in the northern occupied Palestinian territories and one in the south. They have a total population of 830 settlers that live in these three outposts. The legalization, this move was condemned by the European Union, the United Nations, and the United States. The Office of the UN General Secretary has said that all settlement activities are illegal under international law and run contrary to Israel's obligation under the roadmap. The quartet also called for both parties to refrain from provocations. Of course, the Palestinians condemned the move as well, and now we are hearing reports that they will resume their efforts in the UN to seek membership in, at the United Nations. This was in the headlines in today's papers. So this could be a response. This could be a response to the legalization of these three outposts.
Why is it allowed to happen if so many people say it's wrong and should be stopped?
Well, historically, the international community, the UN, the members at the UN, the EU, would only go to this point of condemnation as part of as far as applying real pressure, political pressure. They have not done so against Israel, and this is why this could be an explanation why Israel is going this far with building settlements, with legalizing other outposts. A lot of these outposts are built on private Palestinian land. Some of the settlements that are built in the occupied Palestinian territory.
Ibrahim,
were
going to leave this here for the moment. Thank you very much, sir. And now this week's global resistance reminds us that the world is with the Palestinians, and we sincerely hope that some of their actions will inspire you in some way.
Bradford gave Viva Palestina Arabia convoy a warm send-off. A green open-top bus with Palestine banners was followed by more vans and hooting cars, displaying huge posters and Palestinian flags. Loki's Free Free Palestine could be heard blazing through speakers of the vehicles as they passed through Bradford's town centre, with passers-by wishing them well. Activists showing their solidarity to hunger-striking political prisoners were cruelly tear-gassed and skunked in Bil'ain. As they demonstrated, Israeli forces doused the area continuously with tear gas. The activists, who have gone on an open-ended hunger strike in solidarity with the political prisoners, suffered from suffocation as Israeli officers confiscated their gas masks. Bristol Festival of Ideas will be hosting the launch of John McCarthy's book, You Can't Hide the Sun, A Journey Through Palestine. The book peels back the curtain to reveal the heartbreaking experiences of Palestinian Arabs in Israel. McCarthy draws on extensive eyewitness interviews and on his own experiences to uncover the true story behind the founding of Israel.
And from a jam-packed show, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode of Remember Palestine. Thank you for joining us and showing your solidarity, and of course for watching. I've been Amina Taylor on behalf of the entire team. See you soon.